Great. So today we're happy to have Joseph Toby-Smith from Cambridge, who is going to tell us about undulating dark matter and the guts of U48. Go ahead.
Cool. So hi. This talk is going to be slightly unconventional in that it's going to be split into two distinct halves. The first half is going to be looking at undulating dark matter, and the second half is going to be looking at the guts of U48. And the reason I've done this is just that when I was writing the seminar, I found that neither of these could be expanded to long enough to fill an hour without dragging it on for a bit and people getting bored. So these two halves are only related by the fact that I've worked on them both. Apart from that, they are completely distinct. So let me go on to the next slide. Here we go. So this is basically the overview of what I'm going to be talking about. Like I said, the first half is going to be about undulating dark matter. And this is a paper that I did with Joe DeFeige, who's a postdoc in Cambridge, and Matthew McCulloch. And the second half is going to be about the guts of U48, which is a project that I'm still working on, so it hasn't finished yet. And in the end, it will probably be with my supervisor, Ben Kupayas, and Ben Alanak. So in the first half, I'll look at the motivation behind undulating dark matter, the model itself, the UV extensions of the map of that model. And in the second half, I'm going to tell you the problem that we're looking at in this project. I'll tell you why it's interesting, and then the solution. Okay, so let's go on to, before I do that, if I find myself going too quickly or speaking too quickly, which often happens if I get excited about something, I may just backtrack and repeat a sentence again. So if you find that I've repeated a sentence, it's probably because I figured that I said it too quickly. Okay, so before we go into the nitty-gritty details, I want to make sure we don't lose the forest for the trees. So the two main points of this undulating dark matter project is that modulations are easier to detect if you have a noisy background or a noise that you don't know or that is difficult to model. And the axons plus an EDM can lead to a modulation. Okay, so that's the two basic concepts that we're going to take throughout this first half. So let's go on to the motivation. There are three bits of motivation behind the model or the thing that I want to talk to you about in this first half. The first is the fact that if you have a large background, then looking for modulation is useful. So as an example, imagine we had a little experiment like a box, and that box measured or it beeped every time it detected an event. Now that the number of times it beeps, which you can plot in this pseudo experiment type of plot, is a combination of both the signal, the thing that you actually want to look at, and the noise. Now, if you don't know what the background noise is, or you don't know how to model it, then you can't gain much from this plot because you don't know how much of it is noise and how much of it is signal. That's one case, but let's say we ran our experiment again and we saw something like this. Now, even though we still don't know what the noise is, we can see there is some sort of modulation going on. And of course, I probably exaggerated it here just to make sure that you can see it. My point is that if you have a modulation and you assume your noise is constant with time, that tells you something about the signal that you didn't get if you didn't have a modulation. Okay, and this is how hearing aids work actually. So in the olden days, hearing aids, they would just amplify every single sound that went into them. And that made it difficult to listen to stuff in noisy backgrounds. But nowadays, they pick out the modulation of the human voice and they amplify that over background noises, which are less important. So this idea is used actually in the real world, as well as in what I'm going to show you today. To put this into, or to put some numbers on this, let me show you this plot here. And this is one of the plots we had in the paper. Okay, so what this basically says is the x-axis is the ratio of the time it took you to take your experiment to the time scale or the period of the modulation of the signal. And the y-axis is the modulation fraction. So how much of your signal plus noise is modulating? Okay, and imagine our experiment, we measured 10 to the 6 events, say. And what this line here tells us is that everything above this line is excluded at a 5% level. So if we see a flat distribution, so like this on the left, but flat, then everything above this line is excluded at a 5% likelihood level. Okay. So this kind of signifies how beneficial it is to look for modulation in certain frequency ranges. So if your modulation is much faster than your frequency, sorry, than your the time you're taking to do your experiment, then it's just going to get removed when you bin over a time period. And if it's much slower, it's basically going to look like a non-modulating signal.
So is your assumption here that the noise has a white noise spectrum?
Yeah, so I'm assuming that the noise, either that the noise has no time distribution, so it's constant, or the noise distribution is constant with time, or that it has some time oscillation that you know and can remove, if that makes sense.
Yeah, okay, but in this plot, you're assuming white noise, it sounds like.
Oh yeah, sorry, yeah. This plot was found by just taking a flat distribution and saying, okay, let's assume we measured flat, so everything constant with time. Then what modulation fractions does that exclude? If that makes sense.
Okay, sure, great, thanks.
So it's assuming you have a flat distribution and saying, okay, we observe a flat distribution. That's gonna mean our modulation then can't be one of the ways we would have seen that, for example. And this plot basically tells you what modulation fractions is excluded, if that makes sense. Okay. That's the first bit of the motivation. And there's the basic idea I want you to take from this is that if you have a noise that you don't really know, then it's useful to look for modulations. Motivation number two is this plot here. So this plot is taken from the Sensei experiment. And the way to interpret this plot is as follows. So the x-axis here is the mass of your fermionic dark matter. And the y-axis is the cross-section of the scattering of that dark matter with electrons. Okay. And the way these experiments work, or the way the Sensei experiment works, this is going to be a very simplified approach, not because I don't know the details, but it's going to be a very simplified approach of how this experiment works. They basically, as dark matter or some event comes in, it scatters off the electrons and that releases electrons. And what they do is they measure the number of electrons per event. And that goes, and they put that into different channels. So you have the one electron channel where they see one electron, the two electron, the three electron, and the four electron. Now, because they don't really know what the background is, or because the background is hard to model, what they do is they assume everything they see is dark matter. Okay, and if they assume that, this line here is basically the line that the cross-section would be if every event they see is dark matter. And what this tells you is that everything above this line is excluded, because if the cross-section of the scattering of the fermionic dark matter from the electron was bigger than that, then you would see more events than you did in the experiment. Okay, so that's a rough way how to interpret this plot. And in these experiments, the four electron, the three electron channels, they are very low in background. They have about zero, they basically have zero events. Okay, so basically zero background. But the one electron channel has a fairly large background. And it's this one electron channel which is hard to model. it's this one electron channel that we want to focus on because it's large background. And if you have a modulation, that can be useful when you have a large unknown background. Okay, so that's motivation number two. In these direct detection experiments, you have this one electron channel where there's a large background. Motivation number three.
Let me ask. So Sensei doesn't really have time resolution, right?
No, it has.
It has very little time resolution.
Sure, it has resolution on the order of in first weeks, I think we said in the paper. And this, everything I say also holds for Super CDMS. It's more, yeah. The reason I said Sensei is for. Because it's the one I know the most about, basically. But everything I'm going to say works for alpha direct detection experiments. And the time, the frequencies we're looking at are in first weeks and stuff. So it's basically look at your experiment, the count number of amps in each week period.
I see. So just to be precise, so Sensei has a resolution of like day. So the way that Sensei works is that they take data for 20 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they read out and they do that 22 times. So yep. Then they basically have resolution of one day.
Yep.
And then Super CDMS on the other hand is super fast. So they have nano or millisecond resolution or something like that.
Yeah.
So it works differently. But I guess for Sensei, you can just do things that are day-like.
Yeah, exactly. So in a second, when I set the model, we'll see that the oscillation, our oscillation is related to the mass of the axion. And we basically take that to be between one in first day and one in first week, or one in first minute and one in first week. The minute range to do with Super CDMS and the week range to do with Sensei.
I see.
So, yeah.
Okay.
If you're talking about those kind of time ranges, can they really be sure that if they don't understand the background, there's a lot of ways in which a day can come in as a background, right? There's a lot of systematic effects that...
Yeah, I guess they have to, I mean, of course, like if we're dealing with dark matter here, you are going to get oscillations on the scale of a day anyway, because of your rotation of your, of the Earth. What we're assuming here, I guess, is that you can somehow detect those and remove them.
But doesn't that mean they understand their background though? Because it sounds like
sure. Okay. Then.
Not really in the sense that so they don't know what their background is, mm-hmm. but they measure the background day by day. So they have event rates day by day.
Yeah.
And those event rates they know. So if you had a very large modulation and then that's not consistent with the event rate that you measure day by day, then that would be excluded. One of the problems, though, that I immediately see is that the event rate that they have day by day, it's kind of small. So the total number of backgrounds, it's not small. Like once you take into account the 20 days of data or something, but each day has large errors. So then I guess there's just like large Poisson fluctuations every day.
Yeah.
So somehow your oscillations need to overcome that.
Yeah, I've got to be honest. We didn't look too much into the... into the experimental side of this. The main idea of this project is to suggest a model where you can have these modulations. It may be that these are in like Sensei, for example, that these are actually, when you compare it to the actual experiment, then they may not be as significant as I'm going to say they are. That said, I think I could be wrong here, that the Sensei, so far they've only used prototype.
The Minos data is not prototype. So they had the prototype in with very, very little integrated mass and time. The current data is not, sorry, the, yeah, so the current data is not a prototype. I'm not saying that the analysis cannot be done. I'm just not completely sure how big of a modulation will you need to actually
see
for this to be useful in the end. I'm not absolutely sure. Maybe you can win something. It's probably a numerical question.
Yeah, to be honest, I can't answer this because we didn't look too much into this specific experiments or do an analysis comparing it to a specific experiment.
So that's okay. Thank you.
No, don't worry. Okay. The basic idea here is that the one electron channel has a fairly large background. So my third bit of motivation is the QCD axion. Okay, and I know you probably all know a lot about the QCD axion, but for this talk, I just want to take three important points. Okay, the first point is, it's a CP odd field that you get by taking your theta term in your QCD Lagrangian and making it a field, basically. The second point is that if it is cosmologically abundant, then it's going to oscillate. Okay. And the third point is that it allows for a neutron EDM. And the reason for this is that your neutron EDM is CP odd, but everything in your QCD Lagrangian is CP even. So it has to be times by a theta term to make it a CP even term. So for what I want to do, I just want you to remember these three facts of the QCD axion. Okay. And this idea has been used, I mean, the thing I've shown you here has been used to help search for an EDM of the neutron, basically looking for a modulating EDM of the neutron. And what we're going to do is basically take this idea and move it over to the dark sector. So we're basically going to copy the QCD axion, or those three points of the QCD axion. We're going to take a CP odd field, which I'm going to call phi. We're going to assume it's cosmologically abundant, and therefore it's going to oscillate with a time scale about the same as its mass. And this is going to give the dark fermion, a dark fermion, an EDM. And I'll get on to later what we want the dark fermion to be. Just for reference, I'm going to call...
Sorry, can I ask something? I mean...
Yep.
This is leaving out, you need a dark QCD.
To get this.
To have a theta, an EDM, where does the EDM come from? I mean, this is not the QCD axion, right? Because the QCD axion would have a tiny modulation today.
No, this is not a QCD. Yeah, this is, I should have said, everything here is now in the dark sector.
Yeah, so that the axion, in order to couple this way, like it's say that you have some theta problem in there, don't you need some dark QCD?
Yes, one of the UV theories I'm going to say towards the end is going to be dark QCD.
Mm-hmm.
I'm at the minute, just for a more general approach, I'm literally saying, let's know everything else about it, and let's just take a CP odd field. Okay.
Yeah, but can I ask, but that affects the cosmology, right? Because my next question would be, what determines the abundance of chi?
So we assume... What we're assuming is that phi is going to be about 10% of your...
No, the chi abundance, not phi abundance.
Oh, chi we're going to assume is the predominant bit of dark matter.
Yeah, how is it produced?
Oh, yeah, I don't know that. Sorry, we didn't look at it.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. Okay. This is the basic model we're using, or the basic idea behind our model. And every time you write down a model, you have to make sure it's fine-tuned, and or not fine-tuned, rather. And the contributions to the axion mass we have come from this term, which is a coupling to the EDM. And I should have mentioned we also have an MDM term, which gives you this here, this term on the right-hand side. And you can find, or the fine-tuning condition we're going to use is that the mass, or the correction due to these two diagrams to the axion mass, is much less than the mass of the axion itself. And when you do the calculation, I'm not going to go through it here, that corresponds to this condition on your EDM, or your effective EDM, where this includes, if I go back a slide, this includes your sine phi of Fm.
Can I ask something else about the cosmology? So yeah. How heavy is your M phi?
How heavy is M phi? Yeah. M phi will be in the order of 10 to the minus 20 to 10 to the minus 15 electron volts.
Okay, so how big is your modulation?
Modulation is going to be the size of the modulation.
Yeah, today. Yeah.
It's going to be, okay, so we're assuming, I'm not sure I can tell you a number off the top of my head. Actually, no way I can. This is our, in a second I'll show you, okay, this is our fine tuning line.
For a reason. What I'm wondering, if you take the number for a modulation, in the previous plot, this is 10 to the minus 3, right? You were showing some modulation, characteristic modulation that you can see, 10 to the minus 3.
Yeah.
If I take those numbers and translate it to a theta value, you find that the axion becomes order 1, given how theta, you assume the axion redshifts like dark matter, right?
You're talking about this plot here.
Yeah. So if I take, is this a characteristic fractional modulation that you're thinking?
No, this plot has nothing. Okay. This plot is more of an illustrative plot. This is just a modulation fraction. So it's basically saying out of all of the signal you get.
Yeah.
This isn't really related to the axion story. Directly. It's more of like a pseudo experiment that says if we have a modulation.
Okay. But then there's the question I have is because now the axion has started oscillating early on, like when the horizon size, if I assume when the horizon was 10 to the minus 15 EV or 10 to the minus 20 EV.
Yeah.
So today that would imply a very small amplitude for that axion. Theta would be very small. So what I'm asking is, how does that, how is that consistent? You either have to make the axion modulate. I mean, I don't know what your fractional modulation that you're setting to is.
So, I think you want to take an actual theta term in your Lagrangian.
Sorry, that again?
You want to follow the QCD analogy and take a theta term in the Lagrangian.
Forget about the theta term. I'm talking about the operator you have, and I'm talking about the cosmological evolution of the axion field. I'm just trying to understand what is the cosmological evolution of your model. And how this can be consistent, because if the axion starts oscillating at the time, let's say the mass is 10, just to take the more extreme parameter of your case, 10 to the minus 15 EV, that's Hubble at BBN.
Yeah.
The redshift at the time is something like what? The temperature is 1 EV.
Like 10 to the 10, I think.
10 to the 10 or whatever it is. Or I think it's like 10 to the 8, maybe, something like that.
Yeah.
So if you start redshifting from that, from an amplitude of order 1 for the axion.
Yeah. You're going to be
suppressed by 8 times 3, it's 10 to the minus 12. That would be the fractional variation of theta today, which sounds like a tiny fraction compared. I mean, that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't think we considered this. What we did is we assumed that the axion was this M5 contributed 10% of your total dark matter density today. And we use that to find the amplitude.
But I don't know. But I'm telling you, like, you need to make sure that you're...
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah, I agree.
Anyway, thank you.
Yeah, sorry. I can't, We didn't look at the cosmology and I can't answer that. Sorry. So this is our fine tuning limit. Okay. And this depends on your M chi, which is the dark fermion, and the square root of R, which we take to be naught. This is the fraction of your dark matter, which is the axion, and we take that to be 0.1. And the rest of it, we assume to be the dark fermion. Okay, so we now have this plot here, which is a plot that shows all of the constraints, or most constraints, on your dark matter, or sorry, on this EDM coupling as a function of your dark matter fermion, the mass of the dark matter fermion. Okay, and this blue line is our fine tuning line. So anything above that is fine tuned, and anything below that is not. Okay, and the red line is the Sensiet-Minos experiment, and this is just a projection for a similar sort of experiment, but with a much larger exposure. The issue, or the thing about this plot, is that it's done for serial modulation. So everything here is done from not looking for modulating signal. And what we kind of want to do is work out what it would be if you have a modulating signal. So we take this plot, which was for our pseudo experiment, and we can kind of form like a 3D plot, which is a function of frequency in one direction. And to illustrate what I mean, let's imagine that T mod over T data was about 1. So your modulation timescale was about the same as the data collection. Let's assume we were here at N equals 10 to the 6, say. So that's 10 to the 6 total events. Then this will tell you that your modulating part can be no more than 10 to the minus 2, say, of your total, of the total signal you detect. So these, you can kind of view this as these lines being brought down by a factor of 10 to the minus 2. But again, this is a very pseudo experiment. But this is the rough idea that if you have this modulating signal, and if you look for this modulating signal, these lines come down because you're modulating the fraction of your field signal that needs to be detectable comes down. Okay, so whenever you write down a model, you have...
I'm a bit confused in this plot. So yep. This plot does not include any modulation.
No, so the plot on the right-hand side is the non-modulating plot.
Okay.
Yeah, and then you kind of, to find the modulation, because it depends on frequency, it's going to be like a 3D plot with frequency on one of the axes and then these two on the other.
Okay.
So when you have a model, you have to tell me the UV theory. And as has been suggested already, a feasible UV theory is to just follow the QCD axion theory exactly. And this is what, this is the way we, when we originally came up with this idea to do, sorry, when we originally wrote this paper, we were following this QCD axion analogy exactly. And then we decided not to for a reason I'll explain at the end in a second. Okay, so this is basically following the QCD analogy exactly. And this is the EDM in the QCD case. We're basically taking the QCD axion and we're transferring it over to the dark sector. So instead of the quark mass, we have a dark quark mass. This first EDM is just got bidimensional analysis. Then we have the mass of the axionic field, which is this here, and the mass of your dark matter fermion is basically taken to be the corresponding to what it would be for the neutron transferred over to the dark sector. Okay, and that gives us a EDM, which is this thing here, and then this would be times by the sine phi of F term. Now the issue is that if you plug in your values of M phi and M chi, which is about 10 MeV, for D chi to be anywhere near, which is near a value which is measurable by experiments, then F needs to be transplanckian. Okay, and that's not necessarily good. So this is one reason why we moved away from the QCD-like analogy in the paper, just because you would need trans-Planckian couplings, and you could do some with the clockwork mechanism, or sorry, use the clockwork mechanism to get this down, but we didn't go into details about that. Okay. One of the other things to do is not assume the QCD-like analogy exactly, but assume the QCD-like analogy with large NC. Okay. And in that case, you get, or your dark, sorry, your EDM of your fermion scales as NC log NC. So this is going in the right direction. As you increase NC, you increase the number, so you increase D chi. The issue is, to make D chi anywhere near measurable by experiments, you need NC to be about 10,000. So it's not really feasible in this model either. Our last UV completion is a elementary fermion. And this is copying the analysis done in this paper here. And that's basically just to assume you have a charge scalar and a charge fermion of mass M, and assume your EDM comes from these diagrams here. Okay. And that gives you d chi is this value here, where g is the coupling and m is the mass of the charge scalar and fermion. And then you get a fine tuning condition on chi, which comes from this here. And in this case, you can satisfy the fine tuning conditions and have a d chi which is roughly near the correct values. Okay, so
What plays the role of the axion?
Here, nothing, because we're just assuming the axion is the only QCD. Sorry, we're assuming the axion is just a CPod field, and it's the only CPod field in play. So your EDM has to be times by the axion.
But the other answer is that there is no EDM, and you just have a derivative coupling for that action, depends on the symmetry. So it's not just the only option.
I guess what we're assuming is that there is only, I mean, if you have a term, okay, that's the best way to say it. We're assuming there's only one, okay, ignore the fact it's an axion, I guess, and just take this scalar field to be a CP odd field. And let that be our only CP odd field in the theory, then the EDM of this particle, of this dark fermion, if it has one, has to be times by the axion. Sorry, it has to be times by this CP odd field.
Okay.
That's basically all we're assuming.
Yeah, I mean, satisfies all this. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Okay, so that is the end of the first half. Let me just quickly summarize. I basically said modulations are easy to detect, and that couplings of axions like particles to fermions can create a modulation in the EDM, which you can look at in the experiment. Okay, so this seminar is going to be unconventional in three ways. I said the first way is that it's going to be split into two halves. The second way is that in the middle of a seminar, I like to do kind of a break, which is a time to stop thinking. And this is just to tell you something that I learned, which is not related to physics. Well, okay, it's related to physics, but it's not related to anything else that I'm talking about. So this is just
time. Before you go on, sorry. Yes. A little bit confused, but then that means that when the phi couples, the axion couples to the EDM,
yep,
it's a hard breaking of the whatever symmetry protects the axion, because it's a scalar coupling for that field. It's not a derivative coupling anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're assuming the axion has some sort of translational symmetry.
I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, I thought that was the definition.
Yeah, I guess using axion is probably the wrong thing. We're just taking a CP odd field, scalar field.
Okay.
But you've been careful until now to be careful about tuning issues. Now, do you worry about tuning of the axion mass? I think that's, or the scalar field mass.
Yeah, that was our scalar field mass was this plot here. This is where we looked at the fine tuning of the scalar field mass, and then that corresponded to this blue line on this plot. So above this, we have fine-tuned of our scalar field mass, and below we don't.
I see. Mm. Thank you.
Cool. Any other questions, I guess, about the first half? If not, let me go on to my little break thing. And this is the origin of the word academia. So it's just in a book that I read recently. And it's just a fun fact, I guess, that in ancient Athens, they had these things called gymnasiums. And this is where people both learned to study and fought because in ancient Athens, the training of the mind and the soul was kind of one and the same thing. Athens had three gymnasiums, the Lyceum, the Carthaginus, something I can't pronounce, and the Academy. And the Academy was perhaps the most famous. So when the Spartans came to attack Athens, they destroyed everything outside the city, but left the Academy standing. And one of the other reasons the Academy is so famous is that it is where Plato formed his school of philosophy. So Plato was initially actually a fighter, and it was only after he met Socrates that he became a philosopher. And it was at the Academy that he formed his school of philosophy. And one of his students was Aristotle, who later formed one at the Lyceum. Okay, so let me go on to the second half, which is the guts of U48. Okay, so this is completely different from the first half. And before I start going into details, I'll do the same thing as I did for the first half to make sure we don't lose the forest for the trees. I'm going to tell you exactly what I'm going to do before I do it. So I'm going to find every semi-simple subalgebra of U48, which contains the standard model. Okay. Now, to give the motivation or the context behind this, let me tell you about one of the other things I worked on. So, there we go. Cool. Okay, so I have these papers on anomalies or local anomalies when you extend a C prime model by an extra U1. Sorry, when you extend the standard model by an extra U1. So when we take the standard model gauge algebra and extend it by a U1, okay? In that case, all of your fermions gain charges, integer valued charges with respect to that U1. And to make sure your theory is free of local anomalies, you have to make sure a set of equations are satisfied, and these are called Diophantine equations because they are polynomial equations in the integer valued charges. And what we did in these papers is solve them using number theory. So I'm not going to go into details about this, but this is just the motivation. If you do, I gave a BSM pandemic talk on this topic. So if you want to learn more about this, you can look there. But this is kind of the motivation for what I want to talk about now, because in this project, what we did is we took the standard model gauge algebra and we added a U1 onto it. Okay. The more general question is, what is any larger extension of the standard model? Now, that's a very broad question to ask, so we need to put some constraints on it. The first constraint is we want it to be a subalgebra of U48. Okay, and there's two reasons for this. One, I'm going to assume there's no more fermions other than the standard model ones plus free right-handed neutrinos. And if there are, that somehow the representation doesn't interfere with what I'm doing here. Okay, so that's where the 48 comes from. And the U bit comes from the fact that we want to allow, for example, a kinetic term in your Lagrangian. And for that, you need your algebra to be an algebra of U 48.
Sorry, how big is the standard model representation? So one family is in what?
One family fits in U15. Three families fits in U45.
So you want to put all three families in the same representation?
Not necessarily. I'm not assuming necessarily at this point that everything's in one representation. Things may be in different representations. All I want to do is find subalgebras of U48 which contain the standard model representation.
Sorry, why U48 then?
Because U48, okay, so U48 is the most general symmetry group that can act on the standard model particles, the 45 standard model fermions, plus three right-handed neutrinos.
At the same time. This is what you mean. So you can embed the three families, you mean, at the same fundamental representation of U48. That's the motivation?
No. So what I'm saying...
I'm getting confused because there are smaller, like there are smaller groups you can embed.
Oh, sure, sure. And I'll find them. This is the point. The point is, I take U48.
Yeah.
I'm going to find the subalgebras of U48, which contain the standard model. And those that might not be that every particle in the subalgebras is in the same representation. They may be in different representations, but my criterion is that they somehow branch down to the standard model.
Yeah, but for example, there is, I forget which one, there is E6 or E7 where the standard model, one family can fit in a 27, for example.
Yes, sure.
So and that, why not go with those? Like, they are smaller groups. U48 is very large. I'm still not understanding the U40, where the 48...
Okay, but with U7 or whatever, yeah, the representation it fits into is very large. It's more that introduces more fermions. Okay. If we assume it's a subalgebra of U48, then we're assuming no extra fermions.
So you're saying that E7 will have extra stuff?
Yes, because the representations which your fermion in is larger than a 48 dimensional representation.
It's a 27, I thought.
But that's one family.
Yeah, exactly. This is what I'm saying. That's one family. So you have to put all three families in the same.
This exactly. Maybe this might become clearer as I go on.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah, go.
Yeah. Okay. So at the minute, no, it's a good question. At the minute, let's deal with we want to find subalgebra C48. And it's basically saying, in the standard model, plus three right-handed neutrinos, there are 48 of them, 48 fermions. We take the most general group that can act on them, which is U48. And what we want to do is we want to find subalgebras of this, which act on the standard, which act on the fermions and satisfy alpha conditions, I guess, and contain the standard model. So the next condition we could put on it is that it is reductive. Okay, so we only consider reductive algebras. And what reductive means is that it is a direct sum of simply algebras, which are called G1, G2, G3, and abelian algebras, U1, U1, and so on. And the reason why you can assume reductivity is that from some positivity constraints, or for some positivity constraints to be satisfied, your Lie group needs to be compact. One way to satisfy certain positivity constraints is to take your Lie group to be compact. And if you have a compact Lie group, then its Lie algebra is reductive. So that's one motivation behind having or restricting to reductive Lie algebras. Now, if you were to find every reductive subalgebra of U48, which contains standard model algebra, so the standard model sits in U48, and what I want to do is find another algebra which sits between U48 and the standard model, I guess. That's going to be quite a difficult problem because these adding U1s makes stuff difficult. So the next simplest thing you can do is look for semi-simple Lie algebras. Okay. And a semi-simple Lie algebra can just be thought of as a direct sum of simple Lie algebras. So what the problem of this topic is to find every anomaly-free semi-simple subalgebra of U48, which also contains the standard model. And I've added anomaly-free here just because everything I'm going to show you has this anomaly-free condition in it. But when it comes to actually finishing the paper, I want to remove the anomaly-free condition just to make it more general. So every time I've said this project to someone, they've always asked the same question, has this not been done before? And I don't think so, but if people know it has, let me know. There have been papers on a similar thing. So for this Galman, Raman, and Slansky paper, they looked at classifying all algebras which contain the standard model, but only had one independent gauge coupling. And this basically restricts you to looking at simple Lie algebras and semi-simple, which are the direct sum of the same simple Lie algebras.
So how do you get Yukawas in this theory, different Yukawas?
This will come at the end. So at the end, I'm going to give you a list of algebras. I haven't looked at this yet, but I'm going to give you a list of algebras which contain a standard model. And these are basically every subalgebra of U48, which contains a standard model. And basically kind of like guts that contain a standard
model. Yeah, but the question that I'm asking, I mean, you say, let me see if I understand. I may not understand this correctly. So you motivate U48 because you want to put all three families in the same, with three right-hand neutrinos in the same representation.
No, not necessarily the same representation. This is, okay, maybe.
But then you have extra stuff.
No. So, okay, they can sit in different representations.
Okay.
But I'm saying that the total dimension of the representation they sit in is not larger than 48. So they sit in a representation. It may not be irreducible.
Okay.
Here's the thing. Okay, I think we may be crossing wires here.
So how do how do you write Yukawas between families?
I haven't looked into this yet.
Okay.
This from my as what I've done yet is very. I'm just finding okay. What I'm basically doing is finding every representation of a semi-simple Lie algebra.
Yeah.
That can act on the standard model fermions and reduce it down to the standard model under some branching.
But I mean, forgive me if I'm wrong, but if you want a UV completion that's unified, you may want to figure out how to write Yukawas. And in fact, many guts were rejected because
I agree.
Of problems that come out from trying to write Yukawas.
Yeah, no, I agree. This is kind of like the next step of our project to look at the phenomenology. I'll give you a list of all the guts, and what we haven't done yet is look at the phenomenology of them.
Okay.
But that is the next step.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So the question then is, how do we find, I realize I'm running slightly short of time, so I'll go through this quite quickly. The question is, how do we find all of the semi-simple subalgebras of U48, which contain the standard model? And this is done in two steps. That is to find every semi-simple subalgebra of U48. And then the second step is to find those which contain the standard model. Okay, so I'll quickly go through the first step. I won't dwell on the details just because of time. To find every semi-simple subalgebra of U48, you basically find irreducible representations of simple algebras, okay? And these are labeled by these Dinkin indices. You find every one of those of dimension less than 48, okay? And then you combine them in different ways to find the reducible representations of dimension less than 48. And this is basically every way you can embed a semi-simple subalgebra into U48. So you can combine them like this, which gives you a reducible representation of a simple Lie algebra. And combine them like this, which gives you a irreducible representation of a semi-simple algebra. And you can combine them like this, which gives you a reducible representation of a semi-simple algebra. then for what I've done, I've added the condition that is going to be anomaly free. That was just there to help me speed up the process. Okay, but this is a slight problem. There are about 10 to the 9 or 10 to the 10 such algebras. And if you were to scan through them 1 a second, it would take about 40 years. And that's too long because of the stuff that I want to do next, which is test which contain the standard model. The way around this is to find every semi-simple subalgebra of U48 without SU2 ideals. So what this basically means is, remember, a semi-simple algebra is the direct sum of simple Lie algebras. And I'm going to just take those that don't have SU2 ideals. I'm going to add the SU2 ideals later on. Okay. Part two of my method is to find those which contain the standard model. Okay, so this is the standard model, and all we need to do is ask which of those algebras contain the standard model. Let me skip this, okay? And the basic process is to first ask which contain SU3C, and this is done with one of Dykens' original or Dinkins' original papers looked at how algebras embed into one another, using these things called defining matrices, okay? So you can basically find how SU3 embeds into these algebras and then test if that embedding or if that SU3 corresponds to the standard model one. So if they pass this test, if they contain SU3, we then add the SU2s back in, okay? So we basically take our algebras and we add the SU2s in any possible way that we can. Then we ask, does it contain SU2L plus SU23C? And then does it contain U1 or the standard model, basically? So I've kind of gone through this a bit quick just because I'm conscious of the time. So let me tell you the results. Okay, there are 182 of them. So there are 182 algebras which contain the standard model and are subalgebras of U48. In other words, there are 182 different representations of dimension less than 48, which branch down to the standard model one. Of course, there are lots that you know, and most of these, unfortunately, are ones that you know or combinations of ones that you know. So there's SU5, SO10, two SO10s, one's conjugate of the other, Patti Salam somewhere here, and there's also for Patti Salamals that people have looked at in the literature. And then there's combinations of them. So here's an SU5, SO10, where one of the generations or one family is in the SO10, and then the other two are in the SU5. Okay, so you get a bunch of stuff like that. And then down here, for example, is an SU12, SU2, SU2, and that is some sort of Patti Salam type model. Okay, so when you have a list of algebras like this, there are two questions you can ask, which are maximal and which are minimal. Maximal basically means there is no G prime which is bigger than G, and minimal means there is no G prime which is less than G. And to find this out, you have to work out all of the different ways the algebras connect to each other, or the ways that they embed in one another. And this is this diagram here. So out of my list of algebras, some which are maximal are these ones here. So this is SU4, SU4, SP6. And some which are minimal are the SU5 of the standard model. And this SU4, SU4, SU2. Okay. And notice that you actually have this big connected graph of embeddings, and it's also this little one out here which is disconnected. So this is basically the point I've got so far with this project, and what I need to do next is do some checks. So the programs that I have that do this are written in C++, just to make them quick. Some of the stuff can also be done in the Mathematica program LieArt, and it's comparing them to make sure they're right. Then to look at if the embeddings work or if they branch representations correctly, and then check for known things. So I kind of already done that in checking for like the SU10 algebra, the SU5 algebra, and so on and so forth. What I want to do in the future for analysis is the relationship to the unification group, U36, proton decay, and also this question about Yukawa couplings. Now we actually have a list of these algebras, and there isn't that many of them. You can kind of go through them one by one.
You also talked about, sorry to interrupt, but did you talk about the Higgses? How are the Higgses embedded?
Okay, no, I haven't talked about the Higgses. This is a good point. There may be more Higgses. I haven't assumed anything about how the Higgses is embedded yet.
Yeah, but also unification, why U36 and not one? I mean, you have the usual SU5 that actually predicts gauge coupling. So the other question I have, mm-hmm. do you get the right normalization of the hypercharge so that you get unification as you do in SUSY models? Let's assume, I mean, the only kind of like unification model that appears to have experimental evidence for, as you probably know, is the one where you assume some like SUSY particles between, let's, I don't know, 1 and 100 TeV, and that is SU5. So there the U1 hypercharge has the SU5 normalization, and then the couplings unify.
Okay. Yeah, so in these models, I'm not necessarily yet assuming you have a unification of coupling.
Okay.
Very generically, these may not have unifications of couplings at this point. I guess they're not really grand unified theories, they're more like petite unification theories that they don't necessarily assume a convergence on a couple, like they don't necessarily they don't necessarily unify the couplings. They're just larger extensions of the standard model, or larger possible things that the standard model could be contained in.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. I want to look at its relationship to the unification group U36, and that's basically the group that mixes families, or basically all the right-handed quarks within each other, and so on and so forth. Then look at proton decay, what happens there. And what I've given you so far is a very brute force approach. If I can make this analytic, then it can be generalized to not just U48, but higher algebras, and that would enable you to find more stuff. But that would require you to add more fermions. Okay, so as a summary of the second half, the aim of this was to find all semi-simple subalgebras of U48 which contain the standard model. And the conclusion is there are 182 of them. Some of them, or most of them, are actually just based on ones you know, combinations of SU5, Patti-Salam, SO10, and things like that. Okay, so that's the end of my talk. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Thank you, Joseph.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So as you said in that last part, you didn't actually find them all. You found them all with this assumption about the ideals. I mean, can you give us a sense as to whether we're missing anything with those ones you threw away?
Oh, sorry. I went a bit quick over this because I was conscious of the time. You add the SU, you actually managed to get them all because, let me go back to this. So G doesn't have SU2 ideals in it, okay? You then ask, does it contain SU3C? Now, the SU3 part no part of the SU3 can be in an SU2 ideal. So you can ask that question without adding SU2 ideals, okay? And a lot of these algebras are going to fail that condition, okay? But some of them will pass it, and those that pass, you then add the SU2 ideals back in. So you find all the ways that you can add the SU2 ideals back in. So in the end, you actually get them all, even though the first step, you kind of have to ignore the SU2 ideals, you add them back in later.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, sorry, I went a bit quick over that just because of time.
Any other question for the speaker?
If not, let me just throw another one out. So in this last part, what does success look like? So let's say you're 5 years down the road, you've solved this problem. what's your goal? I mean, it's kind of a botanist approach to how you might come up with interactions, right?
Yeah.
So what's success look like for you?
I mean, okay. When we started this project, we didn't know what algebras we were going to find when we did this process. Okay. We could have found, it may have been that we had thousands of these, lots of which had never been seen before. It could have been that we found basically the ones you know about. We annoyingly got into this intermittent range of ones that are maybe you haven't thought about before, but they're still kind of boring based on SE10, SE5, and things like that. So, I mean, at this point, the rest of this project is going to be looking at the pheno of these models, see which one you can exclude, see which one you contain. And I would just put it's kind of like a botany approach to it. Just put a classification on those subalgebras of U48, the representations which are of dimension less than 48, which somehow give you the standard model ones. Okay. Like a more forward thing, or like a more futuristic approach would be to say, okay, let's go all the way up to U100. So that allows like far more particles than we actually see, but it will give you more general cases. And that would just give us a massive list of basically every possible semi-simple extension of the standard model. And then kind of whittle that down using phenomenology or experimental results or things like that. It's a very, it's a different approach from then just taking one model and using that. It's kind of trying to say, can we kind of do it all in the best way possible?
Nice, thank you.
Okay, great. So we can thank Joseph again, and I think we can stop the recording. Thanks.
Cool.